Once forged in the fires of PR and journalism, Curtis Dewar and Corey Westbrook united to create C-Squared. Now, on our podcast, we interview musicians and other industry professionals to give you an inside look on how to take your music to the next level.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to the C-Squared podcast with Corey and Curtis, joined by our co-host, Miss Lindsay Schoolcraft, and also joined by our special guest, multi-instrumentalist, composer, and keyboardist for the band Under Oath, Mr. Chris Dudley. Thank you so much for joining us today. We are super stoked to have you on the show.
I'm stoked to be here. Thanks for, thanks for letting me come on and, nerd out about whatever we're about to nerd out about. I'm into it.
Dude, we could nerd out. This is an interview with me. We could nerd out about anything from like Star Wars to baking to mermaids. Things get weird on the podcast occasionally.
Oh, mermaids. If you're into mermaids, I live right down the street from Weekiwachee Springs. I don't know if you know what that is, but they have like a live mermaid show and they do it like every day. And it's like what we're known for here. So if you're into mermaids, make your way down to where I live. You'd love it.
Oh, well, awesome. Sure. Why not? I mean, I can't swim, so that could end either poorly or slightly more poorly. But you know what? It would be an adventure either way.
Yes. And it would be in Florida. So it'd be an adventure just in general, just making your way down here.
Exactly. But Miss Lindsay is going to probably rein us in and actually get us on track with her questions.
Yes. Okay. So I don't know if you can tell, this cat's been here the whole time. I think he's a big Under Oath fan.
I'm a big fan of the cat too. So yeah, good call.
Yeah. Whenever we put it on here at the house, he's usually pretty hyper and running around. So I guess he knew you were on camera today. He's never stayed on camera this long. But anyways, I actually have a burning question because hi, Chris. Hi.
Oh, hi. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too. I've listened to a few of your podcasts and interviews and I didn't really get this, but like growing up, like what was the music that as a kid or in your like early teens that was just like a huge influence on you that maybe some people will like never guess?
So it's interesting. I revisited a little bit of this last night because I grew up in a really small town in Florida. There was like about the population was right about 1200 all in. And there was no music scene. There was no anything like that. So I could listen to, you know, whatever my big brother was listening to or what my parents were listening to. Even to get to a music store was a 30-minute drive. So until I had a car, I had no ability to do that. However, I was super into movies. I was also super into just movie soundtracks. So a big part of, there's the music that I grew up on, like that my parents listened to. But then when I actually started forming my own taste in music and what I liked and what was really speaking to me, a lot of that came from movies. And you know, I look at this sounds so ridiculous to say, but the soundtrack to Mortal Kombat, the first one, was a really big deal for me because it had, you know, Fear Factory, Napalm Death, Typo Negative, Sister Machine Gun, stuff like that. And that just like opened my eyes. I think I was about 12 when that came out. So I got that soundtrack and I started listening to these bands and I was like, oh, I didn't know music could get this heavy. Like up until that, you know, I really liked Guns N' Roses. I really liked, Pantera, things like that. But then, funny enough, that soundtrack turned me on to a lot. And then also there was this other soundtrack that I listened to all the time for this movie called Brain Scan. And I actually just listened to that last night because I was watching the movie funny enough in bed. Soundtracks and that type of music really, when I started coming into my own, that was the kind of stuff I was into. Love Fear Factory, love Napalm Death, Cannibal Corpse, Deicide, stuff like that. But then also on the same token, I was really into Celine Dion and Lenny Kravitz and things like that. So it just depended on what mood I was in.
I just got to give you a massive shout out for the Mortal Kombat soundtrack, like link there. That is one of my favorite soundtracks. That was actually the very first CD that I ever bought as a child or ever got as a child. That's not the first one I bought with my own money. That was The Offspring. But that was my very first CD that I ever got as a wee little, because I think I was six when that movie came out. And yeah, that was my very first CD.
That one was a big deal, honestly. Like I think it went platinum like on the first day. Like it just sold an insane amount of records. And I think it did really well for every band that was on it. And honestly, I wish that there was more of that these days. But you know, industry is different now, but those things were super important to me because I didn't have access to any sort of a, you know, real music scene or anything until I got into my later teens.
That's crazy. You made my little Canadian heart explode mentioning Celine Dion because she's just iconic.
So what's funny is the first CDs I ever bought on my own, I went to this place called Blockbuster Music. I don't know if you had those in Canada, but I bought Pantera, Great Southern Trendkill, and Celine Dion, Let's Talk About Love at the same time. Like they're a double purchase. And I just listened to those, you know, side by side all the time because there were only two CDs I had. So yeah.
Great songwriting on both either way.
Yes. Tell Him, that song that Celine Dion did with Barbara Streisand on that record was just so good. Like my little, you know, 12, 13 year old heart was exploding.
Well, that's my afternoon sorted after this. So thanks for the reminder. So I guess my next question, since we're talking about music, because I feel like I'm finally at this point in my career at the ripe age of 36, I had to ask you, when it comes to sound design and what you've put on records, was there a point where you're like, yeah, like I'm finally getting this, like, this is something I'm really proud of. Like when, I'm sure, I know you're proud of all your song babies, but like when were you like finally with the sounds you were putting into your albums where you're like, yeah, I feel like I'm finally getting this as a composer and producer?
Honestly, probably not until not the new record that we have out now, but the one before that, it's a record called Erase Me. That was the first record that, you know, we did that record after we were broken up for a few years. You know, we thought we weren't going to be a band anymore. And, I didn't play for a long time, but then, you know, I started just writing stuff on my own just for no outlet. I was just, you know, writing music. And Erase Me was the first record that we did after we decided to get back together. And a number of those songs were started with an electronic bass. You know, like they started with electronics and they built from there. And I feel like that record as a whole was where I was like, oh dang, like, you know, what I'm doing, you know, this is me. You know, there were songs and there were parts on records previous that I, you know, were 100% like, I was like, okay, this is what I do. But as a whole, you know, that record was really, really the one. You know, prior to that, there was a song, we had a record called Lost in the Sound of Separation. And there was the last song on that was probably the first time ever that I put something on a record where it was like almost all me. And I was just like, man, this is what I want to do. And it was very like cinematic sounding. And I had been watching a lot of 28 Weeks Later at the time. So it definitely shone through. But yeah, so.
That's awesome. That's so cool to hear, because that album, when that album came out, I listened to it when I was on tour with Cradle, I think, with Wiz in that year. And I remember listening to it and just being like, wow. Like from where y'all came from to coming back. So I'm glad it was that album. That's really cool.
Thanks. Yeah. I like it too, but I'm biased. So yeah.
Right. I hear that.
So Chris, next question I got for you is, can you go over the general strategy that you guys had for promoting the most recent album?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because when we go into doing an album, we are very, intentional that we want to focus almost solely on writing and recording. And, you know, anything that comes after that, whether it's promotional ideas or, you know, people we want to collaborate with on that end, that all kind of comes afterward. But we've worked with some great friends of ours that run a digital or like a creative house called Tension Division. And we've worked with them since we did Erase Me. And we really just collaborated with them. And we were like, look, here's our record. Here's what it means to us. Here's how we feel about it. And we brought them in to say, like, hey, like, you know, what do you see here? You know, and the great thing about Tension Division is they go all in on video, album art, merchandising, you know, different promo ideas, and, you know, anything that's visual that's going on with the record is them. So it's good to be, because we're able to have a cohesive look for the album, you know, in a cohesive story throughout the album cycle. So they've been integral for us. Like, you know, they're great friends of ours, but, you know, also they're just great at what they do. And both times that we've worked with them on albums, the first thing that they show us is the thing where, like, we're like, that's it. Like, you know, there hasn't been like pushback. Like, I remember when we did Erase Me, they, you know, they had like a digital presentation, and they showed us what they wanted to do for the cover and for the artwork, and, you know, these colors that they saw going through the whole album cycle. And we didn't really have any notes. We were just like, damn, you guys are really good. Like, this is going to be it. And then again, when, you know, when Voyeurist came around, you know, they had, you know, they had heard the album, and they said that they felt that it, you know, it felt, you know, like gritty, but also like digital, like high def. And, you know, that was kind of their whole idea behind the aesthetic of the videos, the album artwork, and all that. So, you know, as far as promotion goes, you know, there's cool stuff, and, you know, stuff that we wanted to do that never ended up happening. But, you know, overall, the, you know, the vibe and the look of the album, you know, it's a collaboration between us and them, and they honestly just kill it.
Just out of curiosity too, just as a follow-up on that, like, how many interviews did you have to do in order to promote the album? Just out of curiosity.
I couldn't even tell you. I'm honestly a lot less than we have done in the past, because we kind of went through a stint where the publicist that we were working with would just, you know, we would just have interviews with literally anybody who asked. They would put them through, and we would do interviews with them. So there'd be times when, you know, be sitting down and doing an hour and a half long interview for a, you know, a podcast or a webzine or whatever that, you know, 10 people were going to read. And it's like, you know, we love being able to do that stuff from time to time. But as far as, like, you know, just spending days doing those sort of interviews, when, you know, you got to look, is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, if it's like, well, if I'm going to spend, you know, 15 hours this week doing interviews that a culmination of 1,000 people are going to read or listen to, you know, is that really, you know, is that going to be worth it in the long run? But I don't know. For me, though, I just like talking and chatting with people, so I didn't really care then, and I don't really care that much now. It's just, you know, the fact that this is like part of my quote unquote job, you know, I'll
yeah,
take it, you know.
Yeah, no, I understand completely.
And speaking of the release strategy, this is something I've covered with a lot of new bands, and I see it's something that you did with your release strategy, where you released quite a number of singles over a much longer period of time versus the standard, you know, like 2 singles over 3 months and you're done kind of release strategy. Do you feel that really benefited the release of this album and maybe helped you reach more people or anything along those lines?
No, that was not intentional at all. We had intended, so here's the story. We had an October, I think it was an October 8th release date set. I think we had set that in like May of last year. We had been working with our management, the whole team, the label, everything toward that release date. We released one song as our first, you know, the teaser, you know, whatever you want to call it, the first track, you know, that we put out. And the idea was 3 weeks later, we were going to release a second song, which I think would have been it was like early September. That was going to be, that second song was going to come out. And we are going to say the album's coming out October 8th. Here's the second single. Here's where you can pre-order, you know, have all the links, have everything up to be able to, you know, pre-order the record. And I think we had planned on doing only two songs and then releasing the album. The night before the second song was to be released, we were to announce the release date, have all the pre-sale links and everything. You know, mind you, again, we've been working to this since May, I think. We got a call from our label saying, oh, by the way, you're not going to have any vinyl until 2022. So you can release it in October. You're just not going to have any physical sales. And they told us the night before we were going to announce the release. So we were put in a position where, like, well, we can release the album when we were planning on and not have any physical sales, not have any vinyl, like have all these people pre-ordering this vinyl, but then they're not going to get it until 2022. They said it was going to be December. So we took that as 2022 because you know how vinyl stuff is. So we had the discussion of whether we do that or we just push the release of the album until we have vinyl. That way everybody can get the digital, get the vinyl on the same day. And like, you know, as you guys know, for, you know, release numbers and all that stuff matters a lot. So we had to make like just a game time decision that we didn't know we were going to have to make. And we were just like, damn, I guess we're pushing this record till next year, which we were not stoked about. But then we were stuck in a spot where we had already released two songs. We released that second song anyway. We just took down all the release info. And then we were like, well, we've got from September until February that we have to fill with promo. So I guess we're just going to keep releasing songs. And we did. And, you know, there were a lot of people online that were like, damn, you guys are just like releasing the whole album. And we're kind of like, all right, well, I hope you like the songs. So, what's good, though, is I think that people were able to get a really good sense of what the album was going to be, because I don't like when a band releases an album, they release like a song or two, but then when you listen to the album, it's like, well, this isn't what the album sounds like. You release these two songs that don't sound anything like what the album represents. But we are very careful what songs we did release, you know, because we wanted it to kind of like run the gamut. Like, because, you know, the normal thing you would do is, you know, release like a big single first, or like the super like heavy thing first and then a big single, and then, you know, another single, you know, more accessible song or whatever. But we decided to kind of flip that, and where you would normally release like a big single, we release one of like the more long, jammy, weird songs on the album, because we really wanted to put forth that like, hey, this album's heavy, this album is you know, we experimented a lot on it, and you know, we wanted people to get a sense of that. So yeah
awesome. Anybody who's worked in the industry for longer than 30 seconds is very well aware of the vinyl issues that go on right now. And yeah. Hey, at least you found out before and not like the week later.
Yeah.
Even if it was the night before.
Yeah. I mean, that silver lining, you know, lining for sure. I kind of look at that like you're okay. So your friend has, you know, you have something going on at 8 o'clock. And it's a 30-minute drive for your friend to get to your house. And then they call you at 7:58 and they're like, hey, I'm going to be 30 minutes late because I'm leaving now. It's like, oh, you knew a half hour ago that you were going to be late. Like, you know, so I was looking at it as like, well, how long have you guys known that we weren't going to have vinyl? You wait until like the night before to let us know. But, you know, it's one of those things though where it's not like it's kind of like not a real world problem. Like, even when I like complain about this stuff, I'm like, yeah, but I'm complaining about, you know, the vinyl release for my rock band's album that's coming out. So I try to temper the complaints a little bit.
But I mean, speaking of things that have kind of been upended, your recent tour, one, how did that go? Two, what's it like touring now versus like 2019? I know a lot of people were really excited to get back on the road, but by the same token, there were a lot of people who were kind of apprehensive about getting back on the road. So what camp do you fall in, and how did it feel, and is it good? Is it bad? Is it indifferent?
I think for us, it was kind of a little bit of all of that. You know, we were a little nervous, you know, because we weren't sure exactly how it was going to go. From a, you know, in many different respects, you know, we were like, well, how do we tour, you know, if you want to call it post COVID, you know, when we were touring, you know, cases were way down, hospitalizations are way down, but still it was like, all right, well, it's kind of a new world. But overall, that tour, I think, was one of the, if not the biggest tours that we've ever headlined. Like the sales everywhere were through the roof. And the response to the record was awesome. You know, I think a bit of that was, you know, just people really wanting to get back into a room together, you know, and experience live music. And, you know, there were some issues that we ran into as far as, you know, some logistical things with COVID that we were having to deal with. You know, we had to, I think it was the Toronto show, I think, we ended up having to push because of some border crossing issues with COVID, and it was kind of a mess. But honestly, our crew killed it, and, you know, we were able to push through. But it was a lot more difficult in that respect. But at the same time, it felt like a breath of fresh air, like, you know, everybody getting to be in a room together and be loud and sweaty and, you know, just enjoy a concert. It was just... yeah, it was awesome. And, you know, who knows what it's going to look like going forward. You know, it looks like, you know, cases may be going back up, and, you know, who knows if there's going to be more lockdowns or whatever. But, you know, we're just kind of taking it day by day. And, you know, we initially wanted to come back and tour in 2021, like the summer 2021. The fall, and our team was like, you know, back then, like February, March of 2021, was like, no, like we need to leapfrog all this and get back, you know, wait and go back in 2022, which I'm glad we did. You know, we found that being patient is, you know, definitely better in the long run rather than trying to like shoehorn in like as soon as we can get back into places. So I'm thankful that we did that.
I just had a quick follow-up for you, Chris, just about the touring. How did you figure out which bands to add into the package? I know there was originally a different band scheduled, but what's kind of the process you guys kind of go through to pick the openers, if you want to say?
Yeah, so it's a combination normally of, you know, our agent will come to us and say like, hey, who is it that you want to tour with? You know, who are bands that you're digging? We'll send him a list of bands. He will send us a list of bands that, you know, he thinks would be good. And, you know, we have like columns and we go through and we're like, hey, what about these guys? What about these guys? And, you know, initially we had Every Time I Die on the tour, you know, and that was a purely like, they're old friends of ours and we love those guys and we love their music. And it was just like a no brainer for us to have them on the tour. But then unfortunately they broke up. And, but at that point we had Spirit Box on the tour and they were a second of four. But in the time between when we booked the tour and when the tour actually happened, you know, they grew a lot as a band. So we were kind of just in a spot where like, well, we don't have to find a new direct support band because Spirit Box is now big enough to be direct support. You know, we just have to find a band to fill that other spot. And Bad Omens was brought to us by our agent, actually. And he was like, hey, you should check these guys out. I think they would be a really good fit. And, you know, they hadn't come across all of our radar yet. You know, some of us had heard them. But, yeah, it was kind of a quick thing because, you know, we heard them and we liked their music. And, you know, he said they were rad dudes and we hadn't met them before that tour. So it was cool to be able to, you know, get to know them and, you know, Spirit Box as well. And we had toured with Stray from the Path before. So that was, you know, just old friends hanging. So
cool.
Yeah, that was a really good show that night.
It was,
despite, you know, it getting pushed and everything. When I saw that Bad Omens was opening, that's why I dragged along Curtis because he's a big fanboy.
Oh,
so
nice.
that's why this
great night. I had so much fun.
It was my first concert back in like over 2 years or something. So it was a magical evening for sure. I'm up next for another question. So I wanted to know about film score stuff because I love your work and I love what you're doing. And it's really admirable because you go from like growing up with like loving movies and then going to Under Oath and then coming back around to it. So I have to ask, I know it was your wife who was super supportive and said like, you should just put it out there and ask. When you landed like that first gig, like what was going through your head? Was it like a, okay, and we're like what went through your head when you got that first film?
It was really just like a, well, here we go. Like I was literally just like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm a big fan of just like building the bridge as the train's running across it sort of thing. And I found that, you know, some of my favorite stuff that I've done has been due to that necessity because I've committed to doing something and then I have to figure out how to do it really well. So, there was a lot of trial and error. There was a lot of, I got a YouTube premium subscription because I was watching a lot of YouTube videos and I needed to figure a lot of stuff out really quickly and I couldn't deal with ads. I hit up a couple friends of mine who had done, you know, film work in the past and, you know, tried to get some good advice. But a lot of it was just doing it, you know, just sitting down and writing and realizing what worked and what didn't. But thankfully, you know, the first thing I did was a short, which was great because, you know, I didn't have to tackle, you know, a 2-hour movie at once. It was, you know, it was like a 15-minute short. So that was a good learning process. And, yeah, it was daunting, which I think every movie is for me, even now, like whenever I start one, I'm just like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do here, but hopefully music finds itself through all of this. And yeah, it's just trying not to screw it all up basically.
I mean, that's a good thing to keep in mind. Like, yeah. I know you can't pick your favorite song babies, but like, is there any movies that stand out that you're like super proud of the score that you put together?
Oh boy. That's hard. I did a period piece called Whelm a couple of years ago, and that was the first feature that I ever did, and that was probably the one that I, you know, that holds the most place in my heart because that was the first feature that I did. So like I was very, there was a lot of learning going on through that, a lot of messing up, but at the end of the day, I think that the result was awesome, and I'm super, super proud of it.
It's awesome. I'll check that one out.
Yeah,
thanks for letting me know.
I like it. Yeah, I like it. It's a fun one.
So I have a completely different question since we're out of them, unless Lindsay has a follow up on the film. Cool. I'm just kind of curious, like out of everything that you've done to date, because you've done a lot, which album or song that you've worked on personally, Under Oath or film, are you most proud of?
I don't know. I think proud of is a, I don't know if I would use that verbiage just because like, you know, I'm proud of, you know, everything that I've worked on, but, you know, I think the thing that I would look back the most on and say like, you know, I can't believe that turned out that way. It would probably be, you know, like I was saying that song that we did on an Under Oath album called Lost in the Sound of Separation. The song was called Desolate Earth, The End Is Here. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, again, that was like the first thing that I did that really, I think, was a precursor to what I'm doing now. You know, it was the first thing that I had the run on that where I could be like, oh, I'm just going to do like this cinematic thing. I want it to feel a certain way. And I really, you know, was able to shape that. So it's not necessarily like the thing that I'm most proud of because I think I've done a lot more since then. That's a lot better. But yeah, if I were to narrow it down to a piece of music, you know, that would probably be it. Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah, and then that answer would probably change if you asked me that same question like next week, though. So,
yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. And then my last question is: do you have any advice that you would want to give to anyone that's looking to start a career in music?
My biggest piece of advice, I think, I mean, I'm not, you know, a great person to ask, but I always say that if you're not, if you don't have it in you to do the work and to write and to perform or do whatever it is that you're going to do and not get paid for it, then you're going to quit long before it becomes a career, you know? And again, I can only speak from my experience, but you know, I know there were years where we were doing Under Oath stuff and, you know, we were going on tour and we were paying for it and, you know, we weren't making any money. It wasn't a career. And if we had gotten into the band saying like, we're going to make it, like, this is going to be our career. This is going to be what we do. We would have quit long before we actually, it ended up being a career, because we would have been like, man, like, it's been years. Like, we're just sleeping on floors and eating off a dollar menu at McDonald's. And, you know, I'm paying money at the end of this 6-week tour to do this. Like, that, this isn't happening. But because we had a drive beyond it being a career, that's how we were able to push through it. So, you know, I think that the best artists and the most determined artists are the ones that would be doing what they're doing, whether it's full time during the day or they work a full time job and then they come home and they have something inside of them that needs to come out and they spend an hour at the end of the day writing music. You know, that's, you know, I think that that's the key. And yeah, so I guess that's not really a great answer to the question because that's not a way to make music your career. It's just, you know, it more speaks to, I think, what would be necessary to make music your career, you know, that drive and that passion to do it no matter what. But as far as, you know, actually hopefully making it a career, my biggest thing is always just do the work, you know, just write the stuff, just release it. Having something done is better than something being perfect. That's another thing that I always look back on. And, you know, because I'm as guilty as anyone else. I just have hard drives full of stuff that I started and never finished. And my whole trajectory and career would probably be in a lot better place if I decided to just start releasing stuff years ago as opposed to waiting until it's perfect. So, yeah, just do it. Put it out, you know. Send it to your friends, send it to anybody that you think might like it. And, you know, I always think that, you know, if you're doing something that is quality and is undeniably good, people are going to find it. Especially yeah. Now, you know, cause it's just an unlimited audience. So yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. I think with that, we are out of questions. So thank you very much, Chris, for coming on. And with that, party on, Corey.
Party on, guys.
Party on. Thanks for having me. Goodbye.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please help spread the word by leaving us a 5-star review on your platform of choice. You can also join the conversation by following us on any social media and suggesting guests or topics you'd like to learn more about. Thanks for listening to C Squared.